The stock market continues to set new record highs. And this hour on Focus, we'll talk with personal finance experts Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler about what that means for your investment portfolio. Then there's holiday spending. Economists predict spending will be down this holiday season. We'll talk about why and how that news could affect you. Plus, we're nearing the end of the year, so it's time to look at what you should be doing to get ready for tax season. And Wasby and Keebler welcome your personal finance questions on any topic today on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus comes your way after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is our monthly show devoted to personal finance. And Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler are here to answer your questions. Kevin Wasby is a chartered financial analyst and a lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business. Jake Keebler is a certified financial planner with Blue Stem Financial Advisors in Champaign, and they're ready to answer your financial questions. And you can call them in at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, and you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Already have a question here that I think that was left over from our last time together for Kevin. Somebody wrote in, could your guest discuss the implications of continued quantitative easing on the value of the U.S. dollar and if this should be a cause of concern, quantitative easing?
Good morning, Jim.
Yes, I forgot to say good morning to the both of you. Thank you for being on the program today.
Good morning, Jim.
Thanks for having us. That's a great question. To date, there hasn't been a lot of, discernible evidence that talks about what the quantitative easing programs that literally began back in February 2009 and continue on to the present day have done to the value of the dollar. When you talk about the value of the dollar, it's always kind of a complicated issue because we're going to say the value of the dollar against what? So if it's against another currency, then you have to look at the policies within that economic zone that uses that currency. So whether it's the euro currency or the British pound, the Japanese yen, here's the short way to look at it. All of those countries' central banks have basically been doing programs similar to what the Fed is doing here. And if there's been an impact to the value of the dollar against those currencies, if someone suspects that that would cheapen the value of the dollar, I guess I would say that that result has not been borne out. Because, again, most of those other countries have similar policies in effect. The question is going to be when those policies end and what happens with a more normal environment.
I'm wondering now, of course, the quantitative easing is administered by the Federal Reserve Board, and their presumptive new chair, the vice chair now, Janet Yellen, has been in hearings with the Senate. If she is indeed appointed to that post, what do you think that'll mean for the Fed and, you know, this sort of policy?
I don't think it's going to mean much of anything as a change to policy. In yesterday's testimony, one of the things that I saw was she was asked a question about quantitative easing. And her conclusion was basically the benefits of it far outweigh the potential negatives or costs of it. And I think that follows right along the lines of the current Fed chair, Ben Bernanke. So I wouldn't expect to see any policy changes at all, just given the fact that she'll replace Ben.
Okay. Is this a question for individual investors as a matter of what they're doing in terms of whether quantitative easing is helping them? Or is this something that's raising all boats, hopefully, in the U.S.?
Well, again, that's a good question. Gets us to kind of the general rule, and that would say, regardless of what's going on with either monetary policy, fiscal policy, or whatever, it's always good practice for an investor to consider rebalancing on a regular basis. We've seen the stock market rise 27, almost 28% this year to date, according to the S&P 500 index. And again, it would just make more sense that a person at least once a year rebalance portfolios and not expect things to go on endlessly.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a call here on Focus. And line four, Chuck in Bloomington, you're on the air on Focus.
Okay, thanks a lot for taking my call. I had a question about these index annuities. It seems like I'm hearing a lot of radio programs. They have the, you know, there's paid programming where these guys, they all use kind of the same example where a guy had $500,000 in the stock market in 01 and, you know, went down to half and the guy needed to take $50,000 a year out of it. So basically the guy runs out of money, where if they would have had it in this annuity, you know, he would have had, you know, income for life. You know, they make it sound like almost too good to be true. But when I've looked at these things, it's kind of hard to determine the fees. So I'm just curious what you guys think of these indexed annuities that everybody seems to be selling right now.
Yeah, I've actually taken a look at quite a few of these policies, and in fact, some of the prospectuses and policy information that you get on them are 100 or 200 pages long. So it's no surprise that you have trouble figuring them out. I've looked at plenty of them, and sometimes they leave me scratching my head. My general answer would be, when you take a look at those things, the marketing information and the actualities of the policies may not quite line up as well as you might think. The main problem that I've seen with them is, like you've already mentioned, there can be pretty large fees on them, and so that's one thing that I would caution you when looking at them is there could be surrender periods lasting anywhere from 7 to as long as 12 years, meaning that if you were to surrender the policy in that first 7 to 12 years, you could be paying upwards of 5, 7, or even 9% in surrender charges. So just to kind of give you a general idea of the idea behind this, essentially what happens is you buy this equity indexed policy at a certain rate. So let's say you invest $100,000. The idea behind it is that the returns of this policy, which is an insurance contract, is somehow tied to the market. And so the marketing behind it is you get market returns with none of the downside. So essentially, if the market goes up, your policy goes up. If the market goes down, your policy stays where it's at. And of course, you have to think about it from an insurance perspective and realize that there's no such thing as a free lunch. So what the insurance company must do in order to provide that is, first of all, there are some limitations on the upsides. So what I've typically seen is the market index to which the policy is tied might be something like the Standard & Poor's 500. And the index is only based on the increase in value of the S&P. So it's basically a point to point. So let's say January 1st to January 1st. And that actually excludes any of the dividends that those companies on the S&P 500 pay out. So you're actually losing a little bit of return there. And then in addition to that, there are usually limitations, such as the policy will give you market returns up to 7%, which sounds pretty good until you take a look at the U.S. market year to date for 2013 is up 28%. So you're giving a lot of trade-offs in order to get the upside potential with none of the downside. And then there's a lot of other provisions that kind of get thrown in there that are really hard to understand about how those guarantees work, and you must annuitize the policy. And when you annuitize, there's some other factors that you have to take into account. So they are quite complex.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like what I was like. So I guess to go along with that then, so you don't think they're a very good deal. So Where do you suggest someone put their safe money for retirement so you're drawing an income off of it if it's not something like that? Then so where would you go with some, for your safe money?
Well, I would qualify and say that I certainly have seen some equity index policies that I would not be comfortable with, but that's not to say that there's no room for insurance or some sort of annuity product in a retirement plan. You know, everybody's situation is a little bit different, so you have to take into account not only what are your retirement investment assets, but what are your other sources of retirement income. For someone with a generous Social Security or pension income, they may be able to afford to take on more risk in their portfolio. Somebody who is looking at relying on almost solely investment income will be taking a different strategy. Some things that I might suggest are having a good allocation between both stocks and bonds so that you get both some of the stability and income from the interest earning side of your portfolio as well as the equity side of your portfolio to give you some long-term growth in the portfolio. And then you might be looking at things like CDs or even bond ladders in order to provide some guaranteed income over some period of time, whether it's 3, 5, I've even done them out 10 and 15 years.
Jake brings up a great point. I really do agree with his statement, and you know, it's a reflection. It's a recount of Milton Friedman's saying, you know, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Along with that, let me give you another one that's a favorite of mine, and that's the KISS principle: keep it simple, stupid. I'm the stupidest person in the world when it comes to managing money, and I love keeping things simple. So I'd suggest, along Jake's lines, don't try to capture equity rates of return with an equity annuity, but try to capture the best of the benefits provided in a policy like a fixed annuity for the component of stable income that you'd want to produce for retirement purposes. Use index funds of equities as an added element of a portfolio to capture opportunities for capital gains and to experience a growth rate that should be, you know, a rewarding experience based on just basic economic growth. And then keep a simple ladder of maturities, whether they're CDs or high-quality bonds, that capture a fixed income component as it relates to changing interest rates throughout time. And literally, those three elements can form a very stable basis, a very stable set of legs for a good investment plan that you'd create.
Okay, very good. I appreciate you guys' input on that. So thank you very much.
Chuck, thank you very much for calling. And the phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, to talk to our financial experts, Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler, on this financial advice edition of Focus. And I wanted to ask about just the stock market in general, and you mentioned a sharp rise, so with 28% just this year.
Depending on which index you're looking at, but total U.S. market, when I looked them up year to date, it was about 28%,
and
27%.
I saw the L.A. Times reporting that the broad S&P 500 index is up 25% year to date and has more than doubled since bottoming out in 2009. What is happening in the market when, you know, at a time when there's economic recovery, but it's not necessarily a full speed ahead economic recovery, and we're looking at things like the impact of the government shutdown a month ago. Why are things so hot in the market?
Well, I think that gets me back to the quantitative easing picture. We've seen a very abnormal policy of interest rates from the Federal Reserve again since 2009. A lot of rates of return are basically a reflection of where money is drawn to in an attempt to establish a rate of return. So if we drive interest rates to zero, and that's not exactly true, I would tell you that right now the rate of return on a 6-month Treasury bill is 10 basis points. That's 1/10 of 1%.
That's not absolute zero.
It's not absolute zero, but in a real rate of return, it's less than zero.
Mm-hmm.
So even with the low levels of inflation that we have right now, that's a negative real rate of return. So you're not even keeping up, excuse me, you're not even keeping up with purchasing power. Again, even given the very, very low rates of inflation as the government popularly measures them. The bottom line is when money seeks a rate of return, it's going to assume a level of risk. It should match up. We should never forget that in getting some of these rates of return, 27-28% in the stock market, there's a tremendous risk associated with that. But I'm not saying money is stupid, but money is like water. It will seek its own level. And if it cannot find a rate of return appropriate in something safe, it will gravitate toward more risky things. Why is the Federal Reserve pushing interest rates so low, or have they pushed interest rates so low? Well, again, part of the belief is, you know, priming the pump, so to speak, to get the private sector, the economy, more stable and back, able to create jobs, to create incomes, to let the economy grow at a more normal or natural rate, as opposed to the small rates. But in the process, how much of the distortion in prices and rates of return occurs with this is the $64,000 question.
Okay. And I would just add that when you look at it from a personal investor standpoint, the question of what the market is doing or why is it doing what it's doing may not even be relevant to most people on a daily basis. I would say that for most people, they cannot predict where the market's headed. And in fact, you could even make the argument that nobody can really predict where the market's headed. So this is just another reminder that maintaining a diversified portfolio, and like Kevin mentioned earlier, rebalancing on a periodic basis is such a good idea. So most people are not 100% in the market, and they probably didn't achieve a 28% year-to-date return, but they held a diversified portfolio, and this year they may have earned 8, 10, 12% when you factor in their bonds and other assets. But what they did by holding a diversified portfolio and rebalancing on a regular basis is every year, in order to rebalance your portfolio back to whatever your target allocation is, you sell the asset that did the best. So essentially you sell the winner and you use the proceeds to buy the losers, which for most people seems a little bit counterintuitive because it's like, if I just earned 28% over here, why would I sell that to buy something that maybe earned very little or even maybe decreased in the prior year? But the way that I look at it is a regular systematic system of rebalancing is you're always selling high and buying low, which is the investor's mantra to actually making any money in the market.
Okay. And I was looking at another piece from the LA Times reporting yesterday that the market surge had helped push 401k balances to record highs. Is this all a part of this? Why is this happening?
I would say it's probably very likely related to the market increase. I mean, we are seeing record highs in the market, and so a lot of people's 401ks are invested in a combination of equities and bonds. And so this is just yet another reminder that, you know, we've seen over and over again in the 90s and the early 2000s that people's investment accounts hit record highs. The exuberance of the market got people excited, and a lot of people ended up taking too much risk. And then the story during the next market correction was people are losing half their savings and they may not be able to retire. So this is just a good reminder that the market goes up, the market corrects, but the overall trend is an upward trend. And so I think it's an important reminder that if you're not the type of person that will regularly look at your 401k or your retirement accounts, that you should either be looking at index mutual funds that rebalance themselves automatically, or a lot of employer plans even today are now offering rebalancing systems as part of their 401k platform. So you tell them every year, rebalance on my birthday or the first of the year or select a date. So that is certainly another good option to help investors to avoid taking on too much risk by becoming too concentrated in any one part of their investments.
Jake's hit to a great point. you know, the rebalancing also goes along with another very nice, simple principle that works well over time as it relates to things like 401k plans, retirement plans, where every payroll a certain amount of money is taken from the participant's pay and invested in those chosen assets. Bottom line, what I'm talking about here is dollar cost averaging. Throughout the year, over the years, the nice thing about a dollar cost averaging process is if we don't react to short-term movements, if we don't change or cut back on those contributions because the market falls, if we don't increase them because the market rises, if we just allow those things to continue on and invest in the same assets, every month, if that's when the payroll runs, or every other week, if it's a twice monthly payroll, you basically are buying assets at a fixed amount, and the price is the variable. So over time, what we're finding is you're building up a value of an investment where your average cost should be lower than the value at hand. In other words, it's a nice process that uses the volatility of market prices in your favor. And this is something that, again, simple to do. As long as we don't overreact and say, oh my goodness, I'm going to quit putting money into my 401k because the market went down. No, no, no. That's the last thing to do. Change my allocations. Oh, gee, the stock market is hot, so I'm going to change my allocation from 70% stocks, 30% fixed income to 100% stocks. No, don't do that. And then again, as Jake pointed out, annually rebalancing the results of that, you've got a nice, simple, and powerful system.
Has the nature or the structure of 401ks changed over the years? I mean, do they look different now than they did, say, in the 90s?
They've changed significantly. You've seen a couple changes. The first is employers have moved away from what would have been defined benefit plans, meaning a typical pension plan. And a lot of that is because the costs of those plans were rising. People are living longer. Interest rates are going down. But also the employers were deciding, you know what, we don't want to take the risk anymore. You know, it's up to us to make sure that we're funding these plans enough, and we don't want that risk on us. So they've shifted some of that risk over to the employees through more of the defined contribution, which is your 401k type plan. And so there's some argument about, is that a positive or is that a negative thing? But the other major change that we've seen in the past couple of years has actually been a positive change on the 401k world, which is more disclosure about how much are the fees on the plans, the types of funds that are available in the plans. And the benefit of disclosure is as people get more information, they demand a better product. So we have seen 401ks in the past with really high expenses, you know, funds, mutual funds within these accounts of expenses ranging from anywhere from 1% as high as 1.5% or even 2%, which in today's market, there's no reason why you should be paying those sorts of fees. And so we have seen a lot of employers now offering better selections of low-cost index mutual funds.
Oh. Okay, so there's just there's more choices out there, and if you haven't really looked closely at these things in the last several years.
Right, and employers have been offering more and more mutual fund selections that are diversified, what you might call a retirement allocation fund. And the nice thing about those is they are kind of a set-it-and-forget-it type of fund. You pick the fund based on the amount of risk you want to take or the year in which you plan on retiring, and the fund manager automatically selects the allocation to get you in a diversified mix of bonds and stocks, and then he or she rebalances the portfolio and over time moves it to a more conservative allocation as you near retirement.
Well, it's time for a short break, and we will be back in a moment with more personal finance advice from Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back with a personal finance edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler are here with financial advice for you. Kevin's a chartered financial analyst. Jake is a certified financial planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Call with your personal finance questions. The phone number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Those numbers, of course, toll free. You can email us at will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu, and we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Now, something that is definitely down right now, apparently, are projections for holiday spending for the 2013 season. We're seeing some articles about that. There are some analysts predicting that consumers will trim holiday budgets by about 2%. This is according to the New York Times, and they're saying that retailers and marketers are now redoubling their efforts to woo reluctant shoppers. I don't know what the entire effect of this is on, say, something like the stock market.
Good point. You're right. Some of the economic news that's been out recently, even as late as this morning, has not exactly shown a lot of robust activity. It does not portend for a strong holiday shopping season. And I think that is a worrisome component given what the stock market has done. And within the different sectors of the stock market, those areas that have done the best this year happen to be things like consumer discretionary stocks. So bottom line is I'll look at it two ways. Another good reason to be cautious and not chase the winners. Another good reason to rebalance, annually. The thought I have is the economy is still stuck. It's in neutral. Sometimes it gets into first gear. Occasionally it gets shifted into reverse. And I don't see a lot of change to that anytime soon.
I always hear the phrase, like, there is growth. It's not spectacular growth, but there's some growth. But are there factors that make, say, consumers feel more nervous? The fact that the government shut down for nearly a month, do you think that is having an effect on people?
I would certainly say that fear is never a good thing in investing, and even more than that, uncertainty is never a good thing, especially for decision makers of businesses and small business owners and even families. It's hard to plan for the future when you don't know what your decisions are going to be based around. So, for instance, with the government shutdown, there was a lot of consumers who were facing lost services, or even government employees who were facing lost paychecks. So certainly they were not going to be as willing to go out and make large discretionary purchases such as new cars or appliances, because they may be looking at a cut in pay or even no paycheck for some period of time. So I certainly think that there could be some factors there and fear as well.
Well, I think the other thing too is we've heard some of the fallout from the unintended consequences of the Affordable Health Care Act. I know some people that have reported increases in their personal health insurance costs that are anywhere from, a doubling to a tripling or quadrupling. That doesn't mean to say everyone is going to have that experience. But I think the uncertainty, again, about what the actual cost of living is going to be for an individual or a household has certainly been a brake pedal on discretionary spending, maybe even holiday gift buying as we get closer to the end of the year. When a person faces the possibility that something as important as health insurance costs are going to double or triple, they're obviously going to be cautious in areas where they have discretion.
And perhaps that's the reason, if retailers are trying to pull out these reluctant shoppers, that we're seeing all these reports about big box stores which are now ready to start Black Friday on Thanksgiving Day and open their doors and open their doors next, well, I guess not next Thursday. It'll be the Thursday after next with their big sales.
Well, that, and they do have a shortened shopping season with such a late Thanksgiving. So mm-hmm. that may be another factor playing into some of these projections.
I wanted to point attention to something that's happening today on the U of I campus, and that's actually a rally that the University of Illinois Student Senate is holding. It'll be at the noon hour if you want to show up. They're calling for student loan reform at the federal level, and of course, if you're a college student, this can be a real concern that can stay with you well for years. With the difficulties in paying off student loans, one specific proposal that the Student Senate is backing is calling on Congress to restore bankruptcy protections to individuals with student loan debt. I'm just wondering, just as far as input from either of you, concerning. Concerning student loan debt and how much of a problem it is, and what students and their families can do to make the best of it.
Student loan debt is certainly one of the biggest issues that I would say is facing millennials, Gen Ys, and even some Gen Xers in terms of their own personal financial planning. And you mentioned specifically some of the reforms. It is true, student loans have a unique item that most other loans do not, which is the creditors of student loans have some protections against consumers that they may not otherwise have for more conventional types of debt like credit card debt, auto loans, mortgage loans, that sort of thing, which is that in most bankruptcy situations, student loan debt cannot be discharged. I think you could look at it from two different perspectives. The one is from the student perspective of, if they get themselves in trouble, there's really not that pressure relief valve, which is the bankruptcy route, although for most people you'd really want to look at that as a worst-case, last-case scenario. But from the perspective of the creditors, when the risk of loaning money is lowered, the cost of that debt also lowers. And so what you may see is if there was loss of bankruptcy protections for the creditors, they may be less willing to make those loans and therefore driving up the cost of student loans. So I think there certainly could be a double-edged sword in terms of any policy-making decisions, and I think these are complex issues, so I can't speak to what is the right thing to do. From the perspective of either a potential student or parents of children considering college, I think it's just another reminder that you really need to take a serious look at what the financial costs of attending college might be. And there are lots of good resources out there in terms of helping to make those decisions. But you really need to weigh what is the cost of my education against what is my expected income in the chosen path that I'm pursuing. And some rules of thumb are, it's really, you're kind of getting yourself in a dangerous situation if you take on more debt than your expected first year salary out of college. So for someone who's in a program such as engineering or business where they may have a little bit higher expected salary, a little bit more debt may not be too harmful, but for someone with a low expected salary and a lot of student debt, they may get themselves into trouble pretty quickly. Some resources I might suggest are, there is a website called College Navigator, and this is actually a public resource that's out there, and you can go on and basically look up any university and look up information on how much financial aid do they have available, what are average test scores for students coming in, and what you may find is public institutions are generally considered the least expensive, but in some cases for private schools, if it's the right fit, there may be more assistance available than a public school. So we often recommend this site to our clients to look at with their kids, because you may find that there are universities out there who really want you and will be much more willing to help you get there than attending some of the larger public schools that have huge enrollment numbers.
And I should note that we'll be putting College Navigator attaching it to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus as soon as we can. It can be tricky sometimes, I would think, to really calculate how much money you can expect to make. Things can change within the employment prospects for a profession, or you could be unlucky enough to graduate around the time of a severe economic downturn and find maybe a year's delay in your expectation of getting employment at the level you need to pay off the debt.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's very true, Jim, and those things are certainly outside of the control of any student or any university or anybody involved in the education process. I don't want to sound like a teacher, but I guess I am, so give me a soapbox for a moment.
By all means.
It's one of the reasons why I tell students in class every day, your expensive education is your ticket to exercise your mind. This environment means you have to have a goal of graduating with the best of the best of the best among your peers. And regardless of the economic environment that you graduate into, being at the head of your class, not grade-wise necessarily, but being at the head of your class as being a well-rounded, very well-educated candidate for an employer gives you a highest probability of getting a job offer at a competitive wage. So it's not only what discipline you choose when you go to college, but how you take advantage of the learning opportunities while you're there. We've got wonderful facilities on this campus as it relates to things like keeping our bodies healthy, whether we go to ARC and work out, Circe, or any number of, attractive alternatives to keep physically fit. Those are good things. But I would let the student remind themselves that it's their first opportunity to make their mind as fit as can be while they're earning their education. That's really going to be the competitive edge they have at time of graduation, regardless of what the economic circumstances are.
Yeah, and I think I could add on to what Kevin says by pointing out that you really do need to look at your education as an investment, and it, from the economist's perspective, in terms of maximizing your lifetime utility or happiness, it's not uncommon for someone in early stages of their life to use debt as a means to fund. But you need to keep in mind that at all times in your life, you really need to stay within your means. And so your means as a college student may be using debt to finance some of that, but you need to be cognizant of the amount of debt in proportion to your future expectations.
We have a couple of emails coming in with questions. Our email address is will-illinois.edu. Excuse me, let me make sure that I have that absolutely correctly. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Again, will-talk@illinois.edu. Mike has a question. Getting back to 401k IRA allocation, is there a good reason for a couple in their late 30s to have any money in bond funds and their ilk, given the long-time horizon before retirement? We currently have everything in index funds, blended large cap, small cap, and foreign. At what point should we consider putting bond funds or other fixed income in the mix?
I think there's a component, a reason for a component in there for anyone, regardless of age. I would say it's obvious that the component be smaller when a person is younger, when their time horizon of funding is longer and they can accept more, theoretically, they can accept more risk over time. So two things. I would say that, you know, some amount of fixed income, let's say as little as 20%, is always appropriate, even for a person in their 30s just beginning their working career. In saying that, you're still going to have selective opportunities within fixed income funds. So I would not be shopping right now for any bond fund that is a high yield bond fund. Low quality bonds are higher yielding. I wouldn't go there, nor would I be shopping for a fund that has a long duration or long average maturity. So the bottom line is keep things in high quality categories. Keep them in a shorter time frame. Let's say an average maturity of 3 to 5 years, as opposed to 20 to 30 years, and those should always be fundamental building blocks in the portfolio, in my opinion.
Okay, just want to remind you, we're talking about personal finance right now with Kevin Wasby and Jake Keebler on Focus. Still time for your questions at will-talk@illinois.edu, and the phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Question coming to us about health insurance, and our writer says, or writes, about those substandard health insurance contracts that conservatives are griping about having canceled. Are we going to end up having their non-covered procedures picked up by the rest of us now that they're being extended? It seems to me that they would have to be. And I guess this comes from the extension that the President Obama announced yesterday.
Well, I think that it's certainly true that the calculations upon which the Affordable Care Act were relying upon have certainly changed, because the expectation was, in order to make the funding work for the entire system, everybody has to have a minimum level of care. I'm not an actuary, and so I couldn't tell you what that's going to work out to be. At this time, I believe it's only a temporary extension for 1 year. So what we may see is that everything just gets pushed back in terms of making the whole system work by another year and give them some time to work out the bugs.
I take it this is really hard to foresee the future, because it's part of it is just how this system plays out, but part of it is also what Congress and the White House does to the system to try to shore it up, or, depending on who gets elected, tries to tear it down.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the other thing I would point out is that this particular policy is actually affecting a fairly small proportion of our population. For the people who are covered under, whether it's government health care through Medicare or Medicaid, or for those who are lucky enough to have employer-provided health insurance, this policy change will not likely affect them. The people who this is affecting are those individuals who bought policies privately through an individual coverage through a company whose policy did not meet the standards of the Affordable Care Act. Were told that, yes, their policy was being canceled, but they were being offered new coverage that met this new minimum standard. And for some people, that was a little upsetting, because these new policies were quite a bit more expensive because they include quite a bit more coverage.
Okay. And I gather it's been tough anyway if you're an individual buyer rather than being part of a group. In terms of getting health insurance.
That's correct. So in the past, one of the problems of being an individual is that in order to take out an application, you first had to go through underwriting. And so it's very likely that if you had chronic or persistent health problems, that you may not even be able to get an individual policy. Or if you were lucky enough to get a policy, you may have found that pre-existing conditions were excluded and you're paying those out of pocket anyway. So we are seeing increased costs, but the trade-off is we're seeing better coverage, and we're seeing the ability to get coverage no matter your situation. So if you lose a job, you want to retire early, you want to take a risk and start up your own business, there's no limitations on you can't leave your employer, so you're no longer tied in to your employer for your health insurance.
But are you saying now that it's going back to the original question, is it too early to say that there are some changes being made now with these extensions that is going to be essentially a burden spread around everybody, and so that everybody will be in the long term be seeing more expense for their insurance?
Yeah, I'll go back to what Jake just said here. If the objective of the Affordable Care Act is to have more people covered by a better quality insurance, then it seems to me to be obvious that as an entire system, it will incur higher costs. Now that's only the question of who bears the costs and how. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to provide more benefits to society, there's going to be a higher cost in providing those higher benefits. That you know, can't create magic here. So politics aside, I have nothing against that objective. It really will be the question then of how those costs are distributed.
Okay, so that'll be the question, which may be something of a political football in the next months.
Well, welcome to politics. And again, politics aside, I feel a lot more comfortable predicting tomorrow's or next week's stock market than I do next week's politics.
Okay. It is November 15th. Should I be thinking about my tax filings this early, or is this early at all?
Well, it may not be too early, depending on some of the things that could be taxable events to you. If you hold individual securities or mutual funds outside of a retirement plan, any amount of gains or losses obviously need to be realized before the December 31st to be taxable events for your, 1040 filing that you're going to do. So those are just sort of like tick off review list items that come to the top of the list this time of year every year.
Yeah, you're almost getting kind of late if you want to do any sort of fancy tax planning. But some of the things that you would probably want to be looking at this time of the year are things like reviewing your charitable contributions. If you want to maximize those for the year, you want to make sure you get those in by December 31st. And for those people who are rebalancing at this time of year and who are looking at large capital gains, I would be encouraging them, think about, instead of giving cash this year to your favorite organizations, you can actually give appreciated shares of securities, and you get a double tax benefit. You avoid paying capital gains on the shares gifted, in addition to the deduction for the fair market value of those shares. For those people who are, for whatever reason, looking at lower income this year, you could be looking at things like Roth IRA conversions, which is certainly a good way to take advantage of lower tax brackets. Another thing that I'd be looking at is, if you were talking about a retiree, is if you have any control over income such as IRA distributions, business income, that sort of thing, you might want to be watching out for your Medicare premiums based on your adjusted gross income. So if you generate too much in income, whether it's rebalancing your portfolio, taking IRA distributions, if your income gets pushed too high, you may end up putting yourself down the road in higher Medicare premiums, which are based on your adjusted gross income on your tax return.
Okay. Bonds. I understand, Jake, you've been getting some questions from people about whether or not it's a good time to invest in them right now. And I'm wondering, I don't know why this question is coming up, but is it a good time to invest in bonds?
Well, the question's coming up around a lot of different factors, one of which is the decisions coming down from the Federal Reserve and future expectations and changes of interest rates. And the thing to keep in mind is bond prices are proportional or inversely related to interest rate changes. So if interest rates go up in the future, you would expect that bonds will actually decrease in value. And so the concern is if you invest in a bond-type portfolio right now, you're buying in at an artificially low interest rate. Interest rates will at some point rise, according to this theory, and hurt you in the future. My take on it is you can't time the market. We don't know when interest rates are going to rise, whether it's going to be next week or 2 years from now. 3 years ago, we probably would have been saying there's no way interest rates could go any lower, and then people refinance their homes two more times in that three-year time frame because interest rates just kept falling and falling. So I think there's a little bit of an opportunity cost, because if you hold out on investing in bonds now, you are going to lose out on interest over that interim period, whether it's 2 weeks or 2 years. So I think it's a dangerous game to play, and I can't say that a lot of people will be very successful in trying to do it. I think it's better to just hold a diversified portfolio and rebalance, like we said, on a regular basis.
Kevin, would you go the same way?
Yeah, again, I, to take new money and commit to bonds right now outside of an already structured allocation agreement is not a prudent thing to do, in my opinion. And if a person is using fixed income as a component, which they should be, then I think those allocations should be tilted more toward higher quality and lower duration bond funds or individual bonds. I'm just not going to time the markets, but I am going to say that a zero interest rate policy continuing forever is highly unlikely.
Okay. Well, that pretty much wraps it up for this this hour, or this personal finance edition of Focus. And my thanks to Kevin Wasby, chartered financial analyst, lecturer at the U of I, and Jake Keebler, certified planner with Bluestem Financial Advisors in Champaign. Thank you both for joining us on Focus today. And also a reminder, the Couch Potato Portfolio, the latest edition of which is attached to will.illinois.edu/focus, the, I guess, least a one least effort way of investing, not too much maintenance, and we believe fairly reliable returns. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result in your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show, produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft, our technical director, and Sari Lesk is our intern. Monday on Focus, on the eve of the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, we'll be looking back on the battle that inspired it. Our guest, U of I Professor Bruce Levine, actually thinks that speech by Lincoln is overrated, but that the battle was extremely important, and we'll find out how important on Monday's program. This is Focus on WILL.